No.
This is very much letter of the law.
I forget. The one basically did it. Could any reasonable jury have found? And it was a habeas, so it was complicated. Habeas is. But there was another case where a guy had done 3 months, you know, for being bribed by a Dunkin' Donuts. It's been out for 2 years. Finally got up to them. You know, it was a below guideline sentence, and they said, oh, you can't do that. And, you know, ordered the guy back to jail. Luckily, it went to the Supreme Court, who said, oh, yes, you can. You have to defer to the lower judge.
What does Dunkin' Donuts bribe you for?
Right away, it's Medford. You know, they want a cutout so that they can get. Okay. I don't know.
Right. I mean, cutout. It's called a hole.
a curb cut. Whatever it is.
What is the Speedy Trial Act limitations?
70 days.
70 days. Yeah. It's only federal.
Yeah. It's only federal.
And are there? So they're equivalent in the states. Is there one here?
Oh, I don't know what the state is about, and I don't know if the state has it. But in federal, you've got, well, 70 days is how long you can be imprisoned, and then I believe 90 days till you get a trial. But the reality is a trial takes years because anything that the defense does stays.
Yeah.
And in fact, actually, we had a case where the guy was released because of speedy trial. They just recharged him, went up to the First Circuit. They said, yeah, that's fine. You can do that. So it has no.
So, they can just bring him
so it doesn't mean anything.
Do they recharge him as soon as he steps out of the jail, or they give him a day?
I don't know.
Because on my American Express car rental plan, I have to not rent the car for a day before
I know,
I rent
but I'm not even sure they let him out because this was a bad guy and they didn't want to let him out. So I think actually, I think they moved to keep him in jail while they appealed, and then the appeal came back and said no, 70 days. I mean, it was anyway. The First Circuit. Is not
it sounds to me like if you were viewing the First Circuit on Yelp, you would only give it 1 star.
I don't think you give less.
Its opening hours are acceptable, but the service is bad.
Not if you're the U.S. Attorney. It's really good.
I see.
Really good.
Yes. We'll let them rate it 5 stars.
Yeah.
Does he always get the spit guard because he spits?
You get your own spit guard molded to the microphone.
I
had always wondered about that, that asymmetry there.
But you know what? Maybe you need belt and suspenders. Why don't you take the spit guard and your microphone thing?
We should be ready. I'll go over the logistics real quick.
And should we do introductions around the table?
Yeah,
did everybody know everybody?
Yeah.
I'm Larry.
I'm Molly.
I'm Harry Lewis.
I'm SJ.
Laura.
Brad Bruzzi.
David Abrams.
Dan Jones.
Jonathan. All right, then. I feel like the forms have been observed.
So we have about an hour to record, and however you guys want to apportion Q&As versus formal presentation portions is fine. But just during the Q&A session, we have this mic here that'll go around, and we want to make sure we get the questions on so it can be in the podcast.
We need that window open or closed?
It's not showing up on my
great
monitor. So
okay.
As long as it's still like an oven in here, we can leave it open.
Yep.
An oven you can turn off.
Yes.
Wait, how do you turn off the oven?
No, this isn't an oven you can turn off. Therefore, it's not like an oven, because an oven you can turn off.
I wish you were around to explain all of Larry's cryptic utterances, not just that one. Okay.
What number podcast is this?
This is number 6, I think.
Is it? I don't know. I don't remember. I'm very bad at that.
Ready?
Yeah.
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Zittrin, and with Larry Lessig, I believe this is our 6th podcast, but we stand open to correction. And today we're talking about the future of education, more specifically, ways in which we might be able to reconfigure the very texts from which students learn, more specifically, law students and their casebooks. Let me turn it over to Larry to give a quick sketch of that and the other topic we'll be talking about today, which includes access to scientific knowledge.
Right, so law students learn cases that are written by judges, and if they're federal cases, they're in the public domain. Actually, something like 26 states still claim copyright protection for government materials, but people ignore that typically. So let's say that all these materials are in the public domain. And the striking fact that law students confront is that their casebooks cost hundreds of dollars to compile these public domain materials. And worse, from my perspective, because they are such expensive, huge projects, it's very hard for academics to experiment in different ways to view a case, a subject. So, for example, imagine you're teaching constitutional law, which I teach, and it has a bunch of sections, the First Amendment, 14th Amendment, the Commerce Clause. And I might have a very different way to think about the Commerce Clause cases, but think that Kathleen Sullivan's way of thinking about the First Amendment cases makes sense. And I should be, in my view, able to pick and choose and mix and match to put the material together in the way that I think teaches my students the best. But under the current architecture, it's pretty hard to do that. And so we thought, from the objective of open education and encouraging professors and teachers in all subjects to be able to experiment, because most of the material here is in the public domain, it would be a great platform to begin to experiment with this in the context of casebooks. But it connects pretty directly to a more fundamental issue, which is access to scientific knowledge. And it connects to that because not all the material in a casebook is in the public domain. A bunch of it is law review articles written by law professors or other material that might have been prepared by different academics that's helpful for understanding the facts of a case or helpful for understanding the circumstances of a decision. And that material is typically protected by copyright. And the question that gets raised about open access to scientific knowledge is, do we need the kind of copyright regime that we've got right now for that material? Because the current copyright regime makes it extremely hard to imagine remixing or recombining that material in a very fluid, easy way without the high burdens of lawyers standing between the innovator, the teacher, and the publisher, the people who control the copyrights. So those are the two issues we're going to talk about.
And it is a kind of curious field because for many academics, their one goal is to get noticed. They'd like to have people read their stuff. It's like, please read my stuff. I'll pay you to read my stuff. Not so much, I'm Stephen King, pay me and you can read my stuff. Even though his stuff is all the same. I don't mean to, you know, do a spoiler alert, but it all ends with the main character basically getting out with the secondary category.
He's one of our listeners, you know.
Yeah, that's true, but we haven't paid him. Anyway, we have found that there's just this odd system, maybe historical accident at this point, where if you are publishing in a scholarly mode, you may find yourself being asked to ink agreements and license your work in a way that keeps it locked up pretty well and that makes somebody money, but that rarely makes money for you and that actually precludes people from seeing it, which often is exactly what you want. And the real thing that you are getting in exchange for those limitations is just some branding. So I have a colleague who may be one of the few remaining neo-Marxists in American academia, who shall remain nameless for obvious reasons. And
it's not me.
No, Larry is a Marxist, but he's completely open and brazen about it, such as his oft known and repeated disdain entirely for the copyright system and his hatred of Hollywood. But we digress. So what I found with this guy was he had actually helped sponsor a conference on digital work and on the ways in which people might be exploited as they do stuff online. Coming out of the conference, there may be a book sponsored by, like, Routledge. I don't know. It's spelled in a way that makes it seem British and famous. And they have him editing a book, and they want to collect essays, and I was ready to give one. I said, well, okay, but can we also license them online under a Creative Commons non-commercial license so that you couldn't have, you know, Schmoutledge come and rip it off, but otherwise people could access it and copy and paste it and that kind of thing. And he was extremely apologetic. He said, no, Routledge won't allow it. And I was like, wait a minute, you're a neo-Marxist. Why are you just buckling under for this? Come on, workers of the world unite, huh? And he was like, you know, the academic currency is to get published by the likes of them, and so that's what you have to do. So this does not seem an ideal situation, basically. And Larry explains some of it, too, in a recent webcast of a talk he gave at CERN, C-E-R-N, the Swiss physics people, and gave a talk that you can find online by Googling him and talk in CERN. that explains a lot of the background behind this.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things I tried to emphasize in the talk is that I think that we've been blindsided by this issue in the context of science, because so much of the fight around copyright issues has been in the context of the arts. And, you know, as much as the copy fighters might fight about the extent to which copyright has gone too far, all of us believe that in the context of the arts or huge creative industries, copyright is an essential component to inducing all sorts of creative work. It's what makes it possible to be an independent musician or be an author, and nobody that I think is serious would really talk about eliminating copyright completely. There are abolitionists, but I just don't buy abolition in that field. But because we allow the presumption of the goodness of copyright to exist so strongly in that context, we don't easily distinguish this very separate context of academic creativity. Because in this context, the only people who are really being benefited by copyright are the publishers. And of course, copyright was not intended for the publishers. It was not designed for the publishers. Indeed, when the Statute of Anne was enacted in 1710, the original draft of the Statute of Anne had perpetual copyright. The publishers were really happy about that, but then they limited it. They had a limited term. Publishers were puzzled by that. They thought, well, wait, it makes no sense. You're trying to benefit us. It should be for a perpetual term. But the resolution, finally, in 1774, when in Donaldson versus Beckett, the court holds that copyright is limited, was that copyright is for authors and artists.
And authors are limited because they die.
They die. But publishers indirectly benefit from copyright, but they're not the intended beneficiaries. So the point is, we should be much more supportive of the idea of copyright in the place where it's really necessary. And I think, you know, we all have to come around to figuring out how to make it work in the context of the arts and musicians and filmmakers. But we need, as scientists and academics, to be really critical and skeptical about adopting ways of producing and sharing our work that basically make it completely inaccessible to most of the world, except for those who happen to be inside the walled gardens of elite universities or universities that can afford the extremely high cost that one has to pay to get access to this material.
Yeah, so Larry does this demonstration you'll see in the talk at CERN, where he looks up a topic, I forget which it
campaign
was.
Campaign finance.
Campaign finance, something that he's had some middling interest in recently. And he looks at the top 10 hits on Google Scholar on campaign finance and finds that if he's sitting at his desk at Harvard, he can pretty much read all of them with a click-through, because Harvard has paid through licensed privileges for everybody on the network to get to it. If he were just sitting in his trailer at home and trying to get to
I
it...
I don't have a trailer,
John. I see. I meant his celebrity trailer. But if he were sitting anywhere but Harvard, he instead would get to paywalls of various kinds and finds that it would cost him, I think, 3 to 4 figures just to read the top 10 articles in each of these publishers. So let's tie it back to what we're hoping to do with the casebook for law students. I teach torts, a first-year course, and what we've done is gotten ourselves an ocean of cases that have something to do with torts, an ocean of cases from public domain sources, so that if we were just to offer those cases up to the students to read and copy the hell out of them, there would be no one's rights implicated. Nobody
would care. Let's give
credit
where credit's due. It's actually, it was FastCase, which is trying to be a legal database that gave
yes.
it to you for free.
I didn't know if they wanted to remain anonymous because...
Oh, yes, so, forget that.
Yes, it might be bleeped out in this broadcast, but we got it from a kindly source. And from that ocean of cases, I've undertaken with a group of intrepid former tort students to identify cases that would be good to teach each topic in torts, to then get a lightweight platform designed here at the Berkman Center where those cases can be put into what you'd call a playlist, namely just an ordered sequence of listing that says, okay, here's the playlist for assault and battery. You know, go through the following 8 items, and now you've done your work for assault and battery. The playlist items can link to other stuff on the web, so it doesn't just have to be cases or to just chunks of text. But when it is a case, we can further then edit those cases down, because most of the cases, and I guess we should be clear to our audience that hasn't endured law school yet, that these cases are appellate opinions generally. They're opinions written by judges, when often a case represents the entire headache that is a multi-year litigation with briefs and depositions and all sorts of pieces of evidence. In law school, when you say a case, you usually just mean the final result opinion and edited it that. So what we can do is edit it down. We can maybe insert some of the ephemera, such as the briefs and the affidavits and things like that, if people are interested. And then as the students read those assigned materials, they can actually get to the stuff that we had elided. So you can look at it and see, oh, I see. I want to learn a little bit more about this. These are the pieces of the case that I didn't see before. Of course, in a traditional print casebook, that's really hard to do. You'd have to go online and separately look up each case for which you're interested in more than what is offered to you. And once you go down the playlist and have those edited cases, you in turn as a student can make your own annotations or edits and share those with students in your study group or with successor students that you might identify as interested in what you have. And if you're a professor, you can simply copy and paste either my entire playlist and its contents and then edit it further yourself, or you can just take chunks of it. So it means that somebody else wanting to teach torts can draw from my list, can draw from another torts professor's list, and you might get a lot more mixing and ferment of what counts as a torts course when it isn't limited to one simple book representing just one person's vision of what it is to teach torts. That's what we aspire to, and of course it has its own complications. For the students, it can mean the line between optional and required reading becomes really thin. If something is in the list but it's marked as optional, do I have to read it? Like, I'll be better off if I do. That must be why it's in the list. But if I'm better off and I'm competing with others, well, then don't I have to? And I don't think we've really figured that out yet. We're going to be confronted with that in a way that we haven't before. And for the professors, this may well turn out to be a currency that they can relate to. The kinds of things that drive them to terrible deals with publishers may also drive them to want to participate in a system like this, because if they do a syllabus that's very well regarded, a playlist that's very popular, the system can note that, and they can achieve some professional recognition for inspiring a new way of looking at torts or whatever subject or even cross-subject it could be.
Yeah, I think that's very important, because what we want to do is to encourage lots of professors, especially people just coming into the field, to think creatively about the field without believing they've got to do their whole casebook. And if you can get some return from that, then we're going to get more people to do it. It's just like SSRN, which is the Social Science Research Network, when they first started indicating how many downloads there were of your article, all of a sudden got an extraordinary number of people who wanted to upload their stuff to SSRN just for the chance of being recognized as somebody with a lot of downloads. But the critical thing that's going to make this thing possible is that the materials that people can pull into it, beyond just linking to stuff on the web, be things that are licensed freely. So Richard Stallman, in the context of the free software movement, has long insisted that we speak of free software as free software rather than open source software, to emphasize the sense, as he put it, that freedom here refers to free as in free speech, not free as in free beer.
Always seems such a puzzling metaphor, because people like free beer too.
Not Richard.
Yeah, that's true. He's not improved by it, at least. Because he's already perfect.
Okay, so... but in the context of the stuff that we're doing, you can see why it's so important, because if this material were all licensed freely out there, then it would be easy to pull it into this project and to include it and experiment and do lots of different changes with it. But under the current regime, it's practically impossible to do that effectively or easily without having a gaggle of assistants or lawyers next to you.
And it does raise another question, which is, as we're putting these materials together, there may well be law review articles or other scholarly sources that I think my students would benefit from seeing that I can put in, and so long as they're sitting on the Harvard campus, they can get to. But if you're not part of that licensing agreement, you can't, just like we were talking about before, which then makes my playlist less useful to others that may want to borrow and adapt it. And it kind of raises a question of whether we should be building playlists that mix things, that include both free things and non-free things in the free speech way of viewing it, or whether we should just keep it to materials that are free. And I guess my instinct right now is to incline to the free wherever possible, but if there's some great piece that I know my students with one click can get to, I might well include it in the playlist and just hope that others can come up with some way to get it if they can't.
Yeah, in a devious sort of strategic way, it might be good to have a few non-free things in there so that when the students click to them and realize they've got to go through some steps, they begin to say to the people who wrote those articles, what the hell? Why would you ever do it like this?
We could include on the playlist a complaint form for the preceding item. Like, after you go through the hassle, please fill out the following form to write your member of Congress.
Because what is the argument in favor? You know, now, I was on the board of the Public Library of Science for a while, which of course has launched free, as in free speech, journals in the context of science and medicine.
PLOS.org.
And they have now one of the leading journals in the context of medicine, and very, very highly ranked in all of the areas in which they work. But the thing that they had to do, which was so important to make that work in that field, was to replicate the peer review process. So they have a peer review process, but everything they produce is published in the traditional way of you get paper, and it's freely accessible under a Creative Commons license forever. And they ship the cost up front, so it's the author who's funding the actual publication by a paper fee.
And how much does the author pay?
I think it's up to $1,500, but if anybody needs, you know, there's a way of not paying it if you can't afford it. But in the context of science, that's usually built into the grant process, so that cost is effectively zero to the author. But in the context of law, most of the journals that we have aren't peer-reviewed at all. They're student-reviewed. Students look at this stuff. So we don't even have that to replicate here. So it seems extremely silly for us to be in a business where we're producing this bottled up material that serves no
Wait,
purpose.
So would your ideal be to actually persuade the students who run the journals for 9 months at a time before the next generation of students overtakes them Menudo-like? Would it be to...
What like?
Menudo? Google it.
Right.
But would your idea be just to persuade those students to make their law reviews open access, or are you just saying, what the hell are students doing editing this stuff anyway?
No. I think students are great in what they do. But it's simpler just to get the students and the journals to opt into open access. It was interesting, when I was at Stanford, Larry Kramer, the dean, was very supportive of this idea, and they took it to the Stanford Law Review. The Stanford Law Review kids were like, oh, I think, you know, we shouldn't. For what reason, they didn't really know. And finally, Larry Kramer had to say to them, you know, it's not your law review, and what reason would you have not to make this stuff accessible and broadly accessible? And they have all these kind of tiny little commercial things in their head, like, well, maybe Westlaw won't give us as much money, and it turns out that's not true. Westlaw's completely okay with it. So it does require getting over this inertia, and I find that law review editors are extremely conservative sorts anyway.
Why did they go to law school if they were conservative?
That's a good point.
Yeah. They should be artists. All right, should we open it up to questions or thoughts or reactions? Harry Lewis, who's thought a lot about
education
and scholarship.
It's just it's such an extraordinarily different picture from the business school, which also does cases. They mean something slightly different by it, but where the lockdown is extremely severe, and they make lots of money by selling cases to, you know, lots of places. So there they have and these are creative works, you know, although they're probably a lot of it is put together from, you know, I don't know where the data comes from. Maybe the data is proprietary or not, but.
There's actually two kinds of cases in business school. One kind of case is it's an open or public case, which means it's a case that's produced from public materials only. And the other is a proprietary case in the sense that it's a case that's produced by interviews of insiders in the firm.
For which it can be a great honor for a firm to be chosen. Like, you may have already won, like, we're going to profile you in a case. You're going to be taught at the Harvard Business School.
Yeah. Now, from the standpoint of, you know, creating the right incentives to get people to do stuff, I don't have anything in general with I don't generally object to the idea that Harvard Business School has a business model around producing these cases and profiting off them, and they make an extraordinary amount of money off them. The puzzling thing with the cases, though, in the Harvard Business School, though, is that before the proprietary case can be, quote, published, they have to get sign-off from the company who they've actually reviewed. Now, you might think that creates a different kind of conflict, not a conflict with copyright, but a conflict with the ultimate truth, because, you know, you think about the large number of Enron cases, which the Harvard Business School had, which mysteriously disappeared after the Enron collapse.
Not before going on sale.
So that's a separate issue, I guess. But of course, the cases we're talking about are completely public domain.
And are those Enron, you can't get those Enron cases anymore because they are subject to copyright, and now the publisher doesn't want them to exist anymore.
Means the right to say no.
K-N-O-W. That's what we want, the right to say no. Other reactions? Questions? Amara Miyakawa, who is involved with the H2O project, project manager.
Can you talk a little bit about the role of fair use would play with copyrighted materials being included in these casebooks?
So fair use, of course, is a protection in American copyright law that gives you the right to, without permission from the copyright owner, even if the copyright owner has told you no, use material to make commentary or transform it, or if necessary, to set the context. And of course, one complaint that some people have made is that it's a particularly vague set of protections.
Haven't you made this complaint?
I think I have. We can look that up.
In like three books?
I got it right by the last book. So the vagueness of that means that there's all sorts of uncertainty that leads lots of people to be extremely conservative about it. Indeed, one very close friend of mine, after reading a story by Jeff Rosen about a fair use nightmare where I stole this story from Rosen, I cited him, but in my book, this guy was doing a documentary about San Francisco Opera, and while the opera was playing, he's filming the stagehands underneath, and the stagehands are watching a television, and on the television is a little clip from The Simpsons, and of course this filmmaker knows he's got to get permission to include the clip, so he contacts Mac Groening, and Mac Groening says, sure, contact so-and-so, and so-and-so says, contact so-and-so, and you know, by the end, so-and-so always ends up to be a lawyer, and the lawyer said, I think it was like $10,000 for that clip. And like I said, it's an educational film about an opera. I can't pay $10,000. And the guy said, well, you pay $10,000 or we sue you or you take it out of your film. You pick. It's one of those three. So this judge read this story and said, that's ridiculous. That was clearly fair use. And so we said to this judge, well, you know, you can have the theory of what you as a federal court would say is fair use, but go out and actually look at the practice of what people who actually produce films, publish works, do because of this protection of fair use. And what he found after he did this investigation was that, in fact, they were extremely conservative because the cost of answering even a complaint would suck away all the potential profit from the project. So fair use is a protection, but too often just in theory a protection. But the other limitation to fair use is it's a protection in America. So if we want to make these casebooks that in some sense aspire to a platform that could be accessible universally, not like, you know, the Singaporeans need to read American cases, but you know, they might be interested in medical work from the United States. Fair use doesn't protect that, right? So you know, I find this all the time in YouTube. I do talks on YouTube that include copyrighted material that in the United States is fine. YouTube takes it down. I go through the little process where I have to type in, I promise I'm not a copyright violator, 34 times, and then they put it back up. But not outside of the United States. Outside of the United States, it's all still completely invisible because they don't have the same kind of protection. So
the United States is the land of freedom. The freedom to hire a lawyer, as Larry says.
Great line. Oh.
That's Larry's line. So following up on Harry's question, where he was sort of saying, hey, does the B School, what it does with its cases, should it be, in your view, reworking its business model? And I heard you say, nah, not so much, for reasons that aren't clear to me, but you didn't seem that aggrieved by it. I'm just wondering, what message, if any, do you have for the publishers themselves? Is it just like what the aliens told the Americans to do in Independence Day, die? Or is there something they could do that would make them, in your view, a healthy part of the ecosystem?
You know, I'm fond of saying we shouldn't treat kittens, we shouldn't treat tigers as if they're kittens. And a business and a publisher, for-profit publisher, has an objective to make money on the project. And if you look at the average cost per page or the average cost per citation for for-profit publishers in science and not-for-profit publishers in science, the per page cost is 4.5 times for for-profit publishers, and the per citation cost is 9.2 times for profit publishers.
Which presumably represents, roughly speaking, profit, which is what they're around to get.
That's right. So I think that you know, we shouldn't vilify them. They should be out there trying to make money, but we should be providing a resource in a way that allows the resource to be as accessible as it can be, and then there will certainly be publishers who facilitate the value added that they can put to that, but it won't be making money on the basis of the exclusivity of the
Well, this sounds then more like you're just saying, well, you can't blame someone for trying. You know, the tiger is going to snarl. But you shouldn't, you're addressing yourself more to authors and others that are part of the ecosystem.
Right. So in the context of music, when an author, when a musician says, I'm going to use my copyright to control access to my work so that I can make money and I can become a musician, I say, you know, more power to you. There are a lot of people experimenting with different ways of distributing their work, but I agree, copyright's about giving you the independence you need to be a great author. But when a scholar says, you know, I'm going to write this article and publish it in the Harvard Law Review because the Harvard Law Review is such a prestigious place to publish it, and I'm not even going to ask for it to be licensed freely. Harvard Law Review would say yes if you did, but I'm not even going to ask. I think that they violated a kind of ethical obligation of being a scholar, because I think the ethical obligation of being a scholar is to pursue universal access to knowledge.
But then it sounds like your absence of criticism for the Harvard case study outfit might not be the same for the authors behind the case studies. The professors authoring those case studies, you must think, aren't sharing their knowledge appropriately.
But the reason I find that a hard case is that to get access to that knowledge, they've got to strike a special deal with...
For the so-called proprietary cases.
Yeah, the proprietary. And they've got a way of running a business school. And I don't know that I know enough about the complexity of that. I'm talking about a slice here that I think we can say something reliable about, which is at least the journal articles in the context of scientific report of scientific discovery.
Yeah. It would be interesting to figure out if there's a difference between the kinds of sweat-of-the-brow activities you do as a scientist uncovering new data, or as a law professor writing up something that might be worthy of a law review, how that differs from doing interviews with people at businesses that you do when you're writing a business school case. But I hear your reluctance to just wade in without being open to subtleties among those.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that
this is a mysterious person.
It's Brad Abruzzi, Berkman Fellow. I also should disclose I'm at the OGC at Harvard. It seems to me that what publishers used to offer, of course, was that they could reproduce and distribute your work, which you could not do yourself. On the strength, simply because of that access to a printing press and to distribution channels, they sort of incidentally acquired the power now to distinguish between works that are worthy and works that aren't. And that seems to me what academic writers are stuck on now, is that there is a virtue in getting your work published by the Harvard Law Review. And so when you're given that offer, you take it, and you take, if you were me, you would take it, and you would not ask questions, and you wouldn't push the issue. and I, you know, I wonder to what extent academics are peculiarly suited to overcome that, in the sense that ultimately it ought to be the value of the work that matters. We all need some kind of a proxy, I think, to figure out what we're going to spend our time reading. And it sounds like, you know, we either say, all right, that's the Harvard Law Review, or it's the download count on SSRN. But I wonder if there's some opportunity to be more critical. That is, rather than just generating work, we can be more critical of one another's work and do the work of assigning authority and value to pieces as academics. Because it seems as though we've defaulted on that as part of the job description.
A lot seems nicely up in the air, at least on these topics, because it's not as if we are at some great equilibrium where people, at least in law, but I suspect in many other fields, are utterly confident that what appear in the quote top journals is the top stuff. Now, I'm sure the journals would disagree. Of course, to the extent that those journals are making distinctions, often they're relying upon faculty to do it who are lending their time, not even getting paid. So that talent of sorting might be redirected elsewhere if the faculty in turn thought that that would be a better use of their time rather than the honorific of being an editor at one of these top journals. John Palfrey and I were approached many months ago to draft with our colleagues in the OpenNet initiative, Ron Diebert and Rafal Rosinski, just a chapter in something that's going to be the Oxford Handbook of the Internet by Oxford University Press. And over a year ago, when we were approached about this, we just sent a note that said, you know, we'd be delighted to contribute something, and we would like to be able to put it up on the web for free, and it would also appear in the book. And we got no reply. And instead, we were simply tasked with deadlines, and we went through the editing process and got our chapter right up to the cusp. And now, a couple weeks ago, it's ready to go to press, and we were sent the publishing agreement, which was Oxford gets everything, and you, in fact, get nothing. You get your thing published so that it can reach all the many people who will be buying this Oxford Handbook of the Internet. And we pushed back a little and said, oh, well, you might recall we sent you this email that said we wanted to be make it available on the web. We've done this with other publishers. And they wrote back in an extremely polite British way that was like, F you. Like, no. And we're like, oh, well, because often these things are kind of kabuki theater. You come back with some compromise that might even be just a restatement of what you suggested before, but then it kind of pressures them to compromise. So we came back with, well, what if we were to sort of put it on the web and then people could have it for free? And they wrote back and they were like, how about no? How about you sign our agreement? And we were really close to just being like, well, we tried. You know, and it is about to go to press. And then we were just like, wait a minute. That might work on a Marxist, but we're not Marxists. And we don't want to do that. And it was just this weirdly empowering moment where we're just like, why do we care about this? In fact, if Lessig tweets it, he's got more followers than we'll ever read. God bless you, Bill Dutton, but we'll ever read the Oxford Handbook on the Internet. And like, it's win-win for us. Like, right. Is there really some, like, you know, delta of prestige? Not assuming we are prestigious now, but are we going to get that much more prestigious that we had an article in this thing because it says Oxford? I don't know. Maybe because it says handbook? So we're not going to do it. And instead, we're going to publish it as what Oxford didn't want you to see for free. And it's, like, banned in Boston. And we're going to ask Lessig to tweet it. And you'll probably find it boring. But you'll read it for a few paragraphs that you wouldn't have seen otherwise. So that is one example, maybe, of how things are in motion, but also of how close we were to just rolling with it, just to be polite.
It's a very important story, because I think the most important thing to happen is that senior, not that you're senior, John, you're pretty young still. I mean, you are tenured.
I'm still a kitten, not a tiger. A
kitten, that's right. Yeah. But senior faculty take the lead on this. Right, that because I understand how a junior faculty person is thinking, am I going to get tenure? It's a function of whether my stuff looks prestigious, so I'm going to publish in the Harvard Law Review, because otherwise. But if senior faculty were to say, we're just not publishing in law reviews that don't offer the right to opt into a free licensing system, then I think there's nothing. This isn't like the music industry. There isn't tens of millions of dollars in profits on the other side. So there's no...
Wait a minute. Have I been lied to?
there's nothing that really fights to fight against it. And I just think there has to be a better, a stronger awareness of the people who are creating here that they should be creating according to a certain ethic. And that's the ethic of your stories.
And there are hiring and tenure committees, some of whom have, in the name of fairness and objectivity, at least as a necessary condition, rules, not standards, as we call them in law, about what you are to have done by the time you come up for a particular promotion. You must have at least 3 articles in a peer-reviewed journal that is above X quality or higher as rated by this other journal, which is, by the way, extremely important because at last count there were approximately 97,000 scholarly journals in the world. It was great to see a Wikipedia article about whether every scholarly journal deserves its own Wikipedia entry, or if it must further be notable in order to qualify for an entry. Can you imagine being a scholarly journal that doesn't qualify for placement in Wikipedia? Like, talk about just, you know, getting rated by those you look down upon poorly. Like, that's just really adding salt to the wound. And the great defense of it, as somebody who wanted to see every journal represented in Wikipedia, was I would no more want to see a journal that was not well known excluded from Wikipedia, then I would want to see a village that no one ever visited not included in Wikipedia's geography. So I was like, with defenders like that, who needs enemies? But we digress. This was all a way of saying that you could potentially see a tenure committee adding to its standards, actually making for higher standards, not changed or lower ones, where it adds to the standards, in addition to everything, you also must have at least one article in an open access journal as a way of showing your engagement with a community of people that might be in that zone and not present in another.
Well, the other dynamic about this is that if we moved away from the current system to a system where the way we measured the significance of the journal were these other tools like downloads or links or citations or all these other things, it's these up-and-coming journals that are going to be more eager to deploy those tools effectively because they don't have the reputation of the Harvard Law Review to stand behind them. They need to demonstrate their value much more importantly. And then these committees could look at these things much more effectively than relying upon the fact that a Harvard Law Review has picked it. Now, the other interesting thing about this, counterintuitive for us neo-Marxists who hate publishers, is that if you look at CERN's studies, CERN has a study called the SOAP Project, S-O-A-P, that's trying to evaluate open access publishing. And their first paper that was in September of last year reviewed all the journals and categorized them. And the top journals, the very top journals, the most journals with the largest number of articles, have by and large completely been won over to the open access publishing world. They all permit open accessing of some way. 82% of them permit open access publishing with Creative Commons BY license, the freest of all the license. And the place where there's huge resistance is in the journals that are, you know, one publisher journals, where you've got a single journal around a single society or something like that, where they're extremely restrictive. And those journals are restrictive because they're trying to use restriction as a way to cross-subsidize other activities. So they might have a scholarly society, and they want to find some way to pay for their scholarly society's dinners. And this is the way to do it. Let's restrict access to our material. And my view is I'm all for scholarly societies, and we got to find some way to fund them. But locking access...
You feel ambivalent about dinner, though, don't you?
I do. Locking access just for dinner seems to me not to make sense at all. Now, and I think pressure ought to be put on those kind of journals. So I, in this talk, repeated a story that Carl Malamud first tweeted about JSTOR. And in this story, Carl was quoting the fact that JSTOR's price for getting access to a six-page article published by the California Historical Review was $20 for the six-page article. And I subsequently learned, to JSTOR's credit, JSTOR doesn't set the price for that. It's the journal that sets the price for that. So $20.
JSTOR.org, JSTOR.org.
Right, which is a huge archive of an extraordinary range of scholarly journal articles. But JSTOR is just the pass-through in that place. And so it's the California Historical Society. You want to say, what reason do you have to be charging ordinary people $20 to get access to this six-page article about California history? And if you need to raise your money to fund your dinners or to run your museums, we get that. That's an important project. But restricting access should not be the means to raising those funds. In case anybody's knowing, there are pretzels in this room. That's what the rumbling
is. Oh, sorry. I forgot about the... See, I told you it was here. Yeah.
Told you Larry hated dinner.
Okay, so... your experience side, I'm David Abrams. So in an alter ego, I actually have to get permissions for a first year course for certain materials. And the thing that I thought was very interesting was none of the journal, these are all law journal articles, none of them charged. A lot of them had a handshake. They wanted to know that you were going to use it. You had to request permission and then they automatically granted it. So I think that in the law casebook, you may be in pretty good shape. It would be nice if the tool had an automatic, that there was some sort of agreed upon XML or other scheme by which you could get these permissions handshake that didn't cost anything so that someone could include these materials within their casebook playlist without having to stop and manually go through the
process. And of course one wonders, those permissions that are still could mean an administrative headache if you have a lot of them, but are essentially a headache, a handshake. No Freudian slip intended, a mere handshake to do and no exchange of money. One wonders if you say, oh, and by the way, I'm going to digitize the materials and they'll be available for everyone on the internet for free. They may have a different view than if it comes into your textbook or class materials where 80 to 100 people may come into contact with it.
But I think it's an extremely important point because a lot of times, even in that context, they would be happy with it just because they're going to reference back. And we could build into, for example, the Creative Commons archive, I mean, the Creative Commons attribution technology can build, could be adapted to build into this, the capacity to ping back a certain site for the use.
And that does create a new currency, because as pingbacks roll in, you get excited rather than saying, my God, look at all the theft out there. You're like, wow, my idea is really taking root. And that is the other side of the spectrum from Larry's observation that even once you pay for an article or get your mitts on it, it may turn out that like a key chart in the article is not available because the chart has not been licensed from the same author for reasons that escape almost everybody. Yeah, it was in the CERN talk, actually.
Right, because we're beginning to now license at the element level in the article. So you can license the article but not the graphs, or license the article but not the
I images. Only want the consonants. I don't need the vowels. Can I get like a 10% discount if I just don't have the vowels? Which, of course, is kind of like I'm going to pay more for 320-bit MP3 rather than 128. It's like, you know, sans serif. Well, if you want to read it faster, it's going to cost you. But all this is to say, I don't think any of us believes that there is some obvious magic bullet solution here. There are a lot of moving pieces, and the kind of diffidence I think that Larry showed when I tried to corner him on the B school professors and aren't they bad people, and he correctly said no, B school professors are not bad people. Well, some of them are, yes. Read Harry Lewis's blog for more on that subject. You want to give the URL, Harry?
No, or no. Just,
yes, Google Harry Lewis blog, L-E-W-I-S. And I think we realize that there's a lot of work to be done here. And in fact, as we roll up our sleeves, because we're not just writing about it, we really are trying to do something here with this, for example, Hack the Casebook project. It's hard stuff. I mean, you know, you get a new respect for casebook authors when you try to do your own, especially when what we're doing is starting with just the atoms of these cases and trying to build them into molecules. A lot of the covalent bonds you need, just a few key paragraphs of text in between the cases, that's a lot of work too. And one hope would be that we can get enough critical mass going with our own efforts that others will then, through microevolution and forking it and using their own versions, be able to tweak their way into something really powerful. That's at least the Wikipedia story in its idealized form. But we don't know. It's an experiment, even more so than at the moment Wikipedia is.
Yeah, but I don't think it's as hard as that makes it sound. I mean, I do think there are certain ways of producing knowledge that make it hard. But for the thing that we're talking about, writing journal articles or building a casebook, I understand there's a trade-off. But we had this presentation, you had this presentation at the Harvard faculty lunch yesterday about the Hack the Casebook project. And one faculty member commented and he said, well, you know, I did this casebook. And that's a real opportunity cost with this. That was 3 law review articles. And you're like, okay, how much would you have been paid for those 3 law review articles? So how much do you need to be paid to write this casebook? And I agree it's hard work, and one has to do that work well. And the publisher does something on top. No doubt the publisher adds some value. But the question is whether we should be opting into a system that is allowing that to then be leveraged to the highest possible price, because certain institutions like libraries just have no choice but to buy access to this material.
Well, and that's where it is hard to find among both the producers of the information, here the authors, and among the consumers, a lot of excitement and happiness with the status quo. And some of the intermediaries are okay with it, at least they're doing all right. But it's hard to find a lot of happiness on either end. And as Larry says, there aren't even like the rock stars anchoring the supply side the way there is in music, where, well, at least Metallica is happy. Like, you know, are you against Metallica? And there's no Metallica here for the most part. I mean, there might be a couple authors that are making a mint off their casebooks.
There are. But yeah, and the other thing is, you know, the alternative distribution method, which, you know, Crash Point was raised in the question, it's already pretty clear. I mean, because we experience this all the time. We Google something, or you Bing something. Is that what you would say? Is that the verb?
Yes.
You Bing something. And you come up with a list of things to look at, and you click to them. And what we've got right now is you then click and hit a paywall, which you've got to jump. You jump over if you've got the right credentials, or you bring out your check, your credit card if you don't. And if we didn't have the system of paywalls, we would have the Bing or the Google search.
And you click and you just get it.
You get it.
And then we have a different podcast on behavioral tracking and the observation that when you don't pay for anything, you're not the customer, you're the product.
Uh-huh, all for it.
All right, so we end with Larry Lessig's declaration in neo-Marxist terms that he's entirely in favor of behavioral tracking as long as it means you can get your stuff for free. And that means you'll see this podcast advertised with a flash cookie coming to a browser near you. Until our seventh iteration, I'm Jonathan Zittrain.
I'm Larry Lessig.
We'll see you next time. All right, you're going to cut out that little riff on Richard Stallman.
Coward, you were the one that turned beet red.
Says to me, you've been drinking with Richard Stallman.
So, Jonathan, the weirdest thing about trying to get permissions is
there
were about four. There was one case that was done by someone outside, and it consisted of a bunch of New York Times type articles. So I call them up. They're one or two pages. They want $2 a page per student.
Yeah, right.
Probably not. So I call them up and I say, you know, we've got Westlaw. I can direct them to Westlaw, but actually they're available for free on your website. I can just give them the link. We're perfectly willing to pay a dime a page, you know, 5 cents a page. That's right. What everybody else wants. Nope. But we're just going to send them to your link, and then you won't get the
$1,000. Yeah, but they have a paywall now.
Yeah, but at the time. I'm just saying at the time.
Yeah.
I had this nice discussion where they agreed that I could send them
$2,000. Right.
Or we could just let our students get it for free.
Right.
And they said, yeah, free's better.
Right.
So
I think they worry about proliferation of PDF files.
And presumably if you're sending them to the site, they're viewing the ads, and one of your students might click on an ad.
Except I'm actually sending them to Westlaw, where...
Well, Westlaw pays and blah, blah, blah.
I guess. It still seemed an odd experience.
Yeah. No, it's true that the economics does not seem fully worked out, even at the micro level.
In Business Week, the person wanted $2, and she said, well, I'm really new here. I just started, so I probably can't rock the boat. She at least admitted that it made no sense.
Yeah.
But in general, except for those publications, there was either a very small paywall or none, but there was the handshake. So, now, you're right, you can't pull it in, but if you can just link to it, if that's acceptable in your system. In most of those, I would suspect what they really want is they just want to know that X number of students have read it so that somebody gets bennies for having seen it. And if you build a handshake for that.
In fact, I ran into a mini Tassini problem with the New York Times Magazine, where in my Mean Joe Green book, I wanted to include an article about Mean Joe Green from 1977 or so. And it was before the Times had wised up about its freelancer contracts. So they told me it wasn't even their permission to give. I had to go contact the freelancer who had died, at which point I had to find his widow and presumed but not certain heir to see if his widow would give me permission for three paragraphs of this New York Times story. And my publisher, Aspen, wouldn't let me do it unless I represented I had the permission. They weren't going to go with a fair use path.
Do you think that because publishers can trade permissions to one another?
Like a patent pool.
That's why we have...
I think that's why they have random non-starter pricing to people outside that pool.
Right.
Yeah.
And they are the ones best positioned to actually spend money and litigate if they so chose. Right? But they'll go ahead and give permissions to each other because they might be the one asking.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's a it is just like a patent pool with all of the dangers of that, except that you would think, at least with inventions... Everybody's a sophisticated actor more than people in copyright are sophisticated actors who might just have a blog.
Right.
You know, it touches more people than a patent pool stuff does. Yeah.
I find it super useful if you'd separate the layers of what we call publishing, because we talk about publishing as if publishers are, you know, a natural
monopoly. The monopoly man with a money bag.
Right. And the actual process of publishing now is free and easy. So I always get cognitive dissonance. We probably talked about five different layers of things.
Was getting at that with his question, because he was saying initially what they were really offering was a form of distribution, and then it moved to a form of validation and filtration.
Right.
I guess in scholarly publishing, it does offer access to the libraries of the world. That Oxford Handbook will get purchased just as a matter of course by all these libraries. And
which are being used differently than they were 5 years ago.
That's true. It's not clear anybody else is still going to read it.
Right. So, I mean, for the complex question of how do you get people to use and then point to the results, one of the layers is accreditation for your tenure track. It would be great to have, you could have a group that just did that piece of what publishers now do, and they put out a few hundred stars, a few hundred recognitions every publishing cycle saying, these were great pieces.
Yeah.
You don't have to visit my stats to see that 1,000 people downloaded it. Here is the three-word definition of what you want that you can put on your tenure application.
Right.
And if you just named and called out all those layers, you could then do all the things that...
Well, that is kind of interesting, too, because that does entail, in the first instance, a certain level of centralization of ratings, unless you say, but the centralized system is a federated system that has...
Yeah, but that's like awards. So it functions like awards. You have awards committee in history, and they read all the articles.
Right.
And that's fine, I think. It's a great ex post way of ranking.
But I just, again, it would be worth distinguishing between centralized...
Absolutely.
De facto monopoly award systems and a range of awardees.
But people who people can be trusted to make appropriate judgments based on who they are and their track record, as opposed to a couple hundred years ago, I had a printing press, and I still do now.
Right.
And so I think the problem is that the gatekeepers have that gatekeeping power, and it's entirely incidental to fact that they're established, and so it's really a historical accident that they're in a position to.
Yeah, I agree with that. Which is why I think it's ripe for revolution.
We should do a podcast
about this topic.
Yeah.
God, that would be great. I'd be so nostalgic after we did such a podcast. All right. Well,
thanks.
It is almost Groundhog Day.
That was in February, wasn't it?
All right, boss.
This was pretty good, wasn't it? I was a little disturbed that, even though this is our sixth podcast, no car brought me over from that.
From your office? You would have had to walk farther to get the car.
No, I was down at Mount Auburn.
Oh, you were.
So it took 20 minutes to walk.
Oh, you were at your... You need a monorail. There ought to be a monorail project connecting.
Our podcast ought to be funding a car.
Well, there weren't any.
And I got here late. So, in retrospect...
Izzy, how are you?
Really interesting topics, but...
Good. How are you doing?
Great.
He was just raving about you. There was some project that you were newly heading up, or something you were leading that they were very pleased with.
Good idea today.
What would that have been?
Ooh, what would it have been?
Maybe you know what it was? It was a Seder.
Presided
over a Seder.
That was a serious project. Did you enjoy any Seders?
I did. I went.
I'm trying to think of, like,